Welcome back to Borderline. Wasn't that an excellent hour? I bet you're not used to hearing George, that kind of opinion and perspective, especially on the migration issue, especially from an African. You see, on Borderlines, we bring you what you've never heard before. That was really good. Thank you so much to George Ashiru for that new and fresh perspective. Now, my next guest is here. He's joining me, I believe, all the way from Ireland. I should have a bottle of Guinness, a can of Guinness. No, they do a pint of Guinness. It's only you Nigerians that do bottle. Isn't that so, Professor Scott Lucas? Wouldn't it be a pint?
Look forward to sharing a pint with you next time we meet. In the meantime, it's great to be here with you and all your wonderful listeners.
Thank you so much. Thank you. No, we're happy to have you. I know you're used to my darling sister, colleague, friend Marianne. But this is Borderlines, and Marianne's show is a different show. And your perspective is actually going to be very important. Let me throw something up in the air. It's a question that I'm often asked when I mention your country, Ireland, and I tell them, why are you all getting all hot under the corner, under the collar about Hamas and calling them a terrorist group? When I was growing up in the UK, there was a group called the IRA. They were called terrorists too, but they were fighting for the freedom of the Irish. Would that be a wrong statement, Prof?
I think this is my new country. I just moved here in January. I lived in the UK for 40 years. So I actually saw the Irish question from the UK for many years, but as well as having many people who were in Ireland. And I think the situation with any fight for independence, and certainly you in Nigeria know what it means to try to get independence, is that it's a legitimate cause to want to have your home for you, for your children, for your neighbors. The issue with the IRA, of course, is with the methods that they used to do this. And that is, once you pick up the gun, and especially once you use that gun, not against the British military, but quite often the IRA used it against civilians. Mm. That for me crosses a line. Mm. I'm a great believer in Dr. King, Martin Luther King, who talked about, you know, the fact that we stand together. We have to stand up against oppression wherever it is. But once we resort to violence, we degrade ourselves and we degrade our communities. I think it's interesting now. And as I said, it's interesting now that this is my new home, about how different Ireland is now. I'm in the Republic of Ireland. I'm near Dublin. And this is a country now where Sinn Féin, which was the political wing of the IRA, is now a party.
Absolutely.
And indeed, we have elections coming up later this year, and Sinn Féin could get the largest share of the vote. I don't think they'll form the government, but they get the largest share of the vote. But of course, the point is, they're doing it now through the ballot box rather than through the rifle. And that makes a difference. And up in the north, it's even more striking, is that the first minister of Northern Ireland, so the leader of Northern Ireland, is Sinn Féin.
Yes.
And they have... Absolutely. And what they've done is they've emphasized, you know, they still believe in Irish nationalism. They still would like one Ireland. Mm. But in Northern Ireland, they've emphasized things like, we can deliver housing, we can deliver schools, we can deliver healthcare. In other words, trying to actually govern rather than just agitate. So when we have that Guinness together, especially if you come over here, you can see a bit of it and have these talks, because we have these talks every day in Ireland about people, some of whom have lived through this, some of whom have not experienced it, but what does it mean to have a violent struggle? How do you deal with that in terms of your history? And then how do you get beyond that?
Mm. It is. And I think it's funny you mentioned Nigeria. Here's the other thing I say about Nigeria. I say to Nigerians, my people, there's something I call the Nigerian privilege. What is the Nigerian privilege? The Nigerian privilege is the privilege where we got our independence without having to carry a gun. So therefore, we don't quite understand, the majority of this country don't quite understand when people take a revolutionary action with violence in order to get their freedom or independence. Nigeria is one of the few countries that's in a unique place that we never had to do that in order for us to be, you know, to be a sovereign nation. Let's talk about migration. Gosh, a major global crisis. 281 million migrants globally. But right now, the country that's in the news with all its migrant problem is your old country and my old country, the United Kingdom. They're sending everybody to Rwanda. Is that a smart idea?
You know the answer to that even when you ask it to me. And your listeners know the answer to that question. There's nothing that is wise about a policy of taking an asylum seeker. Mm. So we're not just talking about migrants. We're talking about people who are fleeing deprivation, who are fleeing disaster, who are fleeing violence, and are trying to get asylum. And rather than hearing their cases for asylum, the current government, which is a conservative government, is trying to make examples of them for electoral advantage and say, we'll just send you Rwanda. And again, your listeners will know that Rwanda has got some serious rights issues, including the way they deal with people who come from other, who come back to the country. So let's take this at an initial level. First of all, it's probably a violation. It's probably breaking international law.
Oh, really? And how so? Tell us, how so?
Because if you go back to the 1951 Convention on Refugees and then interpretations of it, there's a principle called refoulement. And refoulement says that you cannot take a person and send them back into a possible position of danger, right?
Right.
You cannot take someone who's seeking asylum and then put them back in a position where they could be detained, where they could be harassed, where they could suffer physical violence. And given the fact that Rwanda does have issues, and these issues are longstanding regarding the system and violence within it, that's a violation of the Convention on Refugees. But beyond that, of course, and beyond the morality and the ethics of this, which we could discuss, is the fact that it's not actually a necessary policy. Something that will never be discussed about in the headlines over here, and I'll explain why in a minute, is that of those who finally get their asylum cases heard, 70 to 75% have the asylum cases accepted.
Mm.
So we're not talking about widespread abuse of the system. We're talking about people who are generally are upheld as being legitimate. So why has this occurred? Because the conservative government is moving harder to the right in terms of its rhetoric. And because it is being outflanked by a party called the Reform Party, which is even harder to the right, this is the way they beat on their chest and say, look how tough we are. Look how tough we are on these people who happen generally to be of a different color than we are. And we can send them elsewhere. So, yes, there is an element of racism in it. There is an element of picking on the poor. And there is an element just simply of cynicism, which is if you want to deal with these asylum cases, fix your system for hearing the case. And that's the big problem here. Is that there's a big backlog on hearing asylum cases because there haven't been enough funds put into the system. It's not organized effectively enough. And so you get people who wait for years to have their cases heard. And what the government is saying is, let's just kick them to the curb and forget about them for good if this policy sticks. And I'm not sure it will, because remember, for years, the UK has tried to do this and has faced a series of obstacles, even getting the first plane back to Rwanda.
Mm. And yesterday, they faced activists who prevented them from moving, you know, the first load of migrants out of the country. Here's the thing. The Conservative Party would say to you, look, yeah, we've had this issue. We've been fighting it. Now we're here. Some of you might think it's a bad idea. You liberals will think it's a bad idea, but this is money well spent. This is us giving these people who wanted to get out of their country to a new country, one of the most successful countries, for want of a better word, in Africa, or at least economically on the outside, successful. And when we get them there, we give them 5 years. We give them money to live there free of charge for 5 years. That's money well spent to a Tory, because once those people are there, once the people know what we're doing, then less of them would want to come here. What would you say to that?
I'm going to start off with the first point, which is, again, to deal with the question about Rwanda. I mean, even if you thought this was a legitimate thing to send an asylum seeker thousands of miles, Rwanda has serious issues regarding its legal and its political system, including the treatment of asylum seekers and refugees. So you are not sending them to a country considered safe. But let's take it this way. If you wanted to spend the money effectively in dealing with asylum seekers, how about spending the money in terms of developing the court system for hearing asylum cases? How about dealing with building up the Home Office so it has the capacity to deal with the cases? How about dealing with this with giving social provision to the asylum seekers so that they have a basic standard of living, so that if they are successful in having asylum, they feel like you've treated them well. You become a member of the community. Here are a couple of things, by the way. Immigrants to the United Kingdom are a net economic benefit to the country. And this has been the case for years. Because immigrants, what do they wind up doing? They wind up coming in here. They wind up studying. They wind up getting jobs and they pay taxes. So they actually have been a net benefit to the UK historically, not a net drain on this. So if you wanted to build up your country, you should actually try to work with people to integrate them into your community. But let me be honest with you. I've got a bit of a bias on this. I've got skin in the game. Why? Because I'm an immigrant. I came to the United Kingdom at the age of 21, and I chose to live there, make a career there, have children there, have a home there. I was not a UK citizen until 2 years ago. I was an immigrant for almost more than 35 years.
From which country?
You know what? In the UK. Now, you know what? But they
no, from which country did you migrate?
US, from the US.
Yeah.
I came from the US, right?
Yeah. And this, sorry to interrupt you. This is the thing. Most people don't realize that even going from as a Brit to the US, you're a migrant, or as a, you know, American to Britain, you're a migrant. And you don't automatically get indefinite leave to remain. But go ahead. So your story is really interesting. Thank you. Please go ahead and finish.
So why did no one ever talk about sending me to Rwanda?
No.
I mean, here's a fun one. Why didn't they talk about sending me to Rwanda? Because I'm a white guy.
Of course.
And I'm just going to put it out. I'm a white guy who was pursuing a professional career. And so nobody talked about sending me to Rwanda. No one has thought of me for those 35 years or whatever as being, quote, a threat to the country. Well, except those who think I'm a lefty professor. But that's a different issue, right? And that's the point here, is that this is also not a policy which is an equal policy. You're going to see those people who are sent, if they are ever sent to Rwanda, coming from certain racial backgrounds, certain ethnic backgrounds, and certain religious backgrounds. And you're going to see others who are from different ethnic and racial backgrounds who are not under the threat of this happening. You know, and so when I lived, and I'm going to add another layer to this. I lived in Birmingham for almost all my life in the United Kingdom. And for those of you folks who haven't had the chance to visit and see it, I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, and I grew up in that state, which was a largely segregated state. I went to a school which was 90%, 6% white. And in a city that was racially divided. When I lived in Birmingham, I was in a multicultural city with people who had come from Asia and had established their country there, with people who had come from Africa, including from Nigeria, from Uganda, from other places, who had made their lives there. I had my children going to school with Muslims, with Jews, with Christians, with people of no faith whatsoever. And you know what? My kids actually grew up with no sense of race the way that I had, because for them it was just people
multiculturalism
just there together,
and yes,
and their multiculturalism. And what made that immigration helped make that system profitable. And again, I'm going to repeat it just in case Nigeria ever faces this issue. Ireland is facing it right now. In the 1940s, waves of people came from the West Indies to the UK, and they helped build up Britain because they took jobs over there. In the 1960s, 1970s, people came from Africa and came from Asia and helped build the country up with the jobs that they did, with the children that they raised. So why is it in 2024 that you suddenly decide that immigrants are a threat to your country rather than an asset to it.
I'm so glad you're here. It's funny, you, like I said earlier, you talked about the fact that you're an American who was in the UK, only just got their citizenship 2 years ago. When I was sort of, I don't know, in my 20s or so, I remember a sister, one of my sister's best friends, you just reminded me, moved from the UK to the US. She's white and she was looking for somebody to get married to. She was looking for an American to get married, and she was actually gay, which was even funnier. Looking for an American to get married to so that she could get her citizenship. But most people, like you rightly said, they look at white people and they don't think that. They think every white person is naturally belonging in a white country without so much, you know, that they could easily be white and be an illegal immigrant. But yet there are many white people who are illegal immigrants in America as well as the UK. That differentiation, that sort of, how should I say, that discrimination we've seen between Ukrainian migrants or the Ukrainian war and the Palestinian-Israel war. Why are Palestinians not being offered refuge in the Western world, okay, in the way Ukrainians were offered refuge in the Western world when the wars kicked up? Why is that?
In just the Western world. Let me tell you a story. Palestinians have been the pawns, not just simply of the fact that they were dispossessed by the State of Israel in 1948. And just a quick reminder, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were displaced during the Arab-Israeli War of 1948. They then went to other countries in the Middle East. They went to Lebanon, for example. They went to Syria. They went to Jordan. They went to Egypt and lived in camps. They had children. Their children had children. There's now 5 to 6 million Palestinians who are effectively stateless because of what occurred. The reason why I say it's not just the West, though, however, is that the states in which they lived, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, would never consider them full citizens of those states, right? Now, there were a couple reasons for that. One is the argument went that if we accept these Palestinians as, you know, citizens of our country, bring them in, then we effectively are letting the Israelis get away with eliminating the state of Palestine, right? And that's actually the situation with Gaza right now. The argument that Egypt will make as to why they won't take people from Gaza coming in is they'll say, well, if we take people from Gaza coming in, we actually help the Israelis depopulate Gaza, right? A lot of it is, of course, by the way, the Gazans don't want to leave, even despite everything they've suffered. But to get back to this, the Palestinian issue has been one which is an issue very much in the region and the Middle East, and it's been a global issue because there's a fundamental here. Until you create a Palestinian state, until you recognize a Palestinian state and give Palestinians the dignity and the respect of having a state, this is going to be a perpetual problem, right? And you can imagine if Nigerians were never given a state in the 1950s, 1960s, if the UK just kept holding on, and the international community let them get away with it. Now, why were Ukrainians treated differently? Not just from Palestinians, but also something else I've covered on a day-to-day basis, from Syrians.
Yes.
Quick reminder, two-thirds of the population of Syria. So I don't know what that would be in Nigerian terms, because I can't remember the population of Nigeria.
We go from 200 to 250, depending on whose Richter scale you're looking on.
Exactly. So you take two-thirds of that number, right? So you get, you know, whichever Richter scale, 140 to 160 million Nigerians would be the equivalent, displaced by the Assad regime's war on their population after 2011. 6.6 million of 22 million people are refugees, another 7 million people displaced inside the country. Almost 14 million people, right? To the credit of some countries in around 2013, 2014, 2015, especially Germany, they took in a lot of Syrian refugees. Germany took in almost 1 million. There were other countries, however, including the UK, who exploited the issue to talk about the threat of immigrants overrunning the country. And they used it. It was used in the UK to justify Brexit. That's how nasty that was, right? Using the poorest people in the world to justify getting out of the European Union. So that type of gutter politics was what was happening there with the Middle East with Ukraine. And again, I write day to day about Ukraine and, you know, very much a supporter of the Ukrainian resistance against Russia. The world, I think, acted properly. The world acted properly in that you had women and children that were an imminent threat. And it was almost all women and children who left because the men had to, are required to stay and fight if they're of military age. You know, you have women and children that just needed to get to secure areas. And now you had countries like Poland. Poland's very, very hostile to immigrants, or have been. But now it took in all the Ukrainians. It took in more than 2 million Ukrainians, right? And let's be honest, what? Because these were Europeans on the doorstep of other European countries. They weren't Africans. They weren't Asian. Mm. And that's why it resonates. So that's the simple difference. What I would have hoped is that there would be no difference in treatment of Syrians, of Sudanese, of Somalians from Ukrainians. You know, that would be my hope of being a citizen of the world. But, you know, that doesn't happen in practice.
Indeed, it doesn't. And that brings us to ideologies. You called yourself a lefty. Why am I not surprised? Look. I would say, and I want you to sort of either correct me or expand on it or even disagree with me, that where one of the things that October 7 has triggered is the growing conflict between ideologies, right? But even beyond that is a sort of narrowing of ideologies. So you have leftists, you have libertarians, you have libertarians or liberals who, like, sort of Hillary Clinton, who you would have thought, hang on a minute, she's supposed to be a liberal, she wouldn't be for Israel, you know, and other, even like Ocasio, you know, those in the Democratic, you know, government in America, you have them and they seem to be lost. They don't know where to go to. Then you've got on the far right, you have the right wing, you know, like Rishi Sunak, even though he wouldn't like to be called that, like Nigel Farage, like Donald Trump, right? Like Liz Truss, who has now come out fully fledged right wing, madam, mistress, whatever. You know, where are we going? What is happening with ideology? And how, and you know, if I may extend that to the fact that you've now got this population of young university students who are natural liberals, right? And they're thinking, this is not what we were told is correct. This is not how we were told that it's supposed to be. Our universities were not built to support right-wing, you know, extreme conservatism, whatever. And now you have Biden, who, quite frankly, doesn't know whether to go left or right, but we do know that Israel is treating him like a rag doll, right? In all of that, you have Israel built on Zionism. Prof, I need you to tell us what's going on with political ideology. What's going on? It's all a mess.
I tell that every day. I'm going to start with a personal story in terms of trying to navigate this and tie it to the events of the past 25 years. When I call myself a lefty professor, I'm just poking a bit of fun at myself. I actually went in America. I went to a university that was a very right-wing university. So I was out of place there. I then went to a left-wing university in the UK where there were socialists and even communists. And I didn't quite fit in there. You know, I sort of kind of floated about. But what happened, I think the formative thing was in 2003 to go back to the Iraq War. Now, I was very much against the Iraq War, right? And I was very much in terms of the idea that this was going to be a disaster because many, many people were going to get killed. Whatever you thought about Saddam Hussein, the way that the war was going to be conducted was going to get a lot of people killed, and that's what proved to be happening. Several years later, when it came to the question of Syria, I very much favored going in to help civilians in Syria, not by invading Syria, but by giving them protected zones. And I split with a lot of people who criticized the Iraq War. So what happened? Had I moved left or right? No. What happened is that left and right became token positions. Mm. And that is, and I think you see this today quite a lot when we discuss even issues of concern to Nigeria, Africa. you'll have people that will immediately pitch up on the right, right? And that will say, for example, you know, capitalism is the best thing for you. You should belong to the free market. You should basically accept the Western system in terms of the economy. If you don't do that, you're backward, et cetera. Then you have people on the left who say, it's all America's fault. Whatever happens, it's all America's fault, right? You know, if it's in Israel and Gaza, America's fault. Ukraine, Russia, America's fault. Hurricane hit somewhere, America's fault, right? Here's the fundamental. And this actually changed the way I look at events. You start from the ground up. What happens in Nigeria, you start with what Nigerians want, what Nigerians are doing. What happens in Israel, Palestine, you start with what Israelis and Palestinians are doing. And what I think you find there is that left and right become token positions that are not actually starting from any type of moral or ethical basis. So let's apply it to Israel and Gaza, because I've done a lot of interviews on this over the last 7 months. And what I will say repeatedly, is that there are some people who say, it's terrible what Hamas did. Terrible what Hamas did on October 7th. They killed many, many people. It's terrible what Hamas did. Terrible what they did. But then they will not. They'll then say, this justifies what Israel did for the next 7 months. Mm. And then I'll have people who will say, it's awful what Israel's done. It's awful. How could they do this? How could they kill 35,000 people in Gaza? But they will never mention what happened on October the 7th when 1,100, 1,200 people died. And here's the point. You don't separate, if you're moral or ethical, you don't separate that it's okay for one group to get killed, or you ignore one group getting killed and you say, I'm going to focus on the other. But what happens is that people either pitch up with a pro-Palestinian or a pro-Israeli position, and then they ignore the other side that takes place. And when you see it at its worst, when I've seen people who claim to be on the left, who have spent years defending the Assad regime, killing civilians in Syria, by saying, oh, America caused that war. You know, America caused that war. The Assad regime never used chemical weapons against its own people. That's a fake. It's not a fake. It's not a fake, and I know that. Or they'll take a look, say, at Russia and Ukraine. And they'll say, it's the U.S. and NATO and poor Vladimir Putin. He felt like he was going to be surrounded, so he had to do something by invading Ukraine. And there were no, and there have been no Russian war crimes, according to these people in Ukraine. Yeah, there have been. You know, I said a few years ago, and I'm sorry to go on and on, but I wrote a book. I'll tell you more about it if you don't know it. But I wrote in the conclusion of the book, it was a biography of George Orwell. We are beyond the terms right and left. These terms are just political sticks that beat each other with. We need to find a new way of discussing with each other based on dialogue, respect, and tolerance. I'm not sure we're there yet, but at least it's a guide for how I get between ideologies now.
So effectively, I think what you're saying is there isn't a safe ideology to stand, because we're in a place where it's no longer about ideology. It's about moral and ethics. It's about you and your morality and ethics in the way that you think, you behave, and the respect you have for humanity. Am I correct?
My problem with a lot of ideologues is that they divorce themselves from a moral and ethical position, right? Mm. They just simply focus on, this is my idea, which tends to be, I like this, I hate this, right? Mm. Just as a guide, because it's been a guide for me ever since I was at university, there's a guy named John Rawls. And John Rawls is a philosopher. And what he basically said is, look, if we didn't know our position in the world, if we didn't know how much money we had, if we didn't know whether we had a house or not, if we didn't know about our education, what would we agree upon? What would we agree that everyone should have access to? If we didn't know we were well off, we would agree probably that each of us should have a house and that each of us should have an education. Mm. And that each of us could have decent health care and not have to go out and try to find a way to pay for it. We'd probably agree on that. Mm. To me, that's effectively building an ideology out of considering the fundamental about what we need as human beings. And that's the way I would work up out of this, right? Which is, if we started with what people need, for example, in Nigeria on a day-to-day basis, and then built our ideas out of that with respect, think about the type of politics you might have. And if you did that in the United States, maybe we'd spend more time talking about healthcare, education, immigration, the economy, rather than talking about that guy who's on trial in a courtroom in New York right now, and he tweets a lot in all capital letters.
But look, this is the thing about America. America is there. Nobody in the world, until you're dead, nowhere can you get away from the effect of America. America is just present, and it's constant, and it's loud, and it's in your face, and it's shaping your life. Even, you know, the smallest village in Nigeria is being shaped by what's going on in America, which, you know, is unknown to many people. But I know my people will have questions for you. You can call 0700-993-993-993. The female-only line is 0201-465-7190. Send a WhatsApp message to 0809-597-5805. We are streaming live on Facebook and YouTube, Nigeria Info 99.3. Prof, I need to talk to you about capitalism. But you see, as soon as I announce the telephone numbers, everybody starts calling. So hold on to that. Let me pick up some of their calls. We need to talk. I need, because here it is. Nigeria, most of us would say, or at least I would say, and most elites would tell you, that Nigeria is a capitalist country. But then the question is, are we really a capitalist country? Do we even know what we are? So we get to the point of talking about economic ideology. I'll be right back. Let me answer this call. Hello. You can call back. So sorry. If you call now, I promise I'll answer immediately and I'll stop talking. Okay. There they are. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, good afternoon.
Yeah, I was back. I was back on the line.
Go ahead.
I have a direct question. The Supreme Court of England ruled that taking people, asylum seekers, to Rwanda is unsafe. Eventually, politicians went back to the parliament, reworked the legislation in order to enable that particular project. Now, what is the damage that is going to do to the integrity of the Supreme Court, being an independent arm of government in a democracy?
Okay.
Does it mean that politicians are just bent on doing anything they want to do, irrespective of what other arms of government thinks about it? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hello? Oops. Okay. Did you hear that question?
If you could summarize it for me.
Okay, so it was to do with the fact that, look, the Supreme Court in the UK, or at least the Lords, voted against the Rwandan bill, but then Sunak decided, you know what, I'm not going to let these people, the Labour peers, I'm not going to let them stop me. I'm just going to go ahead and pass an Act of Parliament and get these people out. So he's saying, why does that then put the UK's democracy and, if you like, the powers, you know, the separation of powers and always the power that's belonging to the Prime Minister, which was always checked, actually, by the House of Lords, etc.
To give you the technical answer to it, a bill can be, if a bill is rejected by the House of Lords three times, then it's killed off, right? But in this case, the House of Lords rejected either once or twice, and then they just sort of relented at the end. And there's a lot of politics as to why they gave way on this. I think in large part because, to be honest with you, they don't think that many people will be sent to Rwanda because this government's going to be voted out of office within a few months. But it still doesn't address the caller's point, which is, look, any democracy is only a democracy in theory, to be honest with you, that we can all cast our vote. You know, and therefore it makes it a democracy. The fact of the matter is that in between elections, you have representatives and you have systems the way that they are set up. And I just have to tell you that your listeners will know what kind of country the UK is. That it's this combination of a country which supposedly is everybody has the right to say something, and then it's an old aristocracy, right? which is where the House of Lords comes in. And the point is that it sort of stacks the deck which is that a government has sort of like everything is tilted in the favor of the government until they get into a lot of trouble, as long as they have a parliamentary majority. And it just so happens that at this point, this government has been so ineffective and so awful, they can't even do that many awful things beyond Rwanda because they're just useless and they will be gone. And we hope that a Labour government will come in and then simply say, look, Rwanda was a very expensive mistake and, well, not mistake, a very expensive, horrible policy, and we're not going to do that again.
Okay. Hello? Hello? Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
What's your name and where are you calling from, please? Hello? Oh.
Your guest.
I can't. I hear you. Can you try again?
Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Can
yes.
You hear me now?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. I want to ask your guest there. Why is America selling capitalism to developing countries? But instead, Nigeria, we are cutting capitalism. Is capitalism democracy? Is democracy a necessary for capitalism?
Thank you. What's your name? What's your name? It's a shame I didn't get his name. Excellent question that comes. It's a good segue into what I wanted to ask. And I like the way he put it. Look, is capitalism an offshoot and necessary revenue of, you know, democracy? And why is America selling capitalism to the rest of the world? This is his question. Even America is having issues with capitalism itself. We can see the damage it's doing to the country.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about capitalism, as with a lot of isms, you've got like the slogan, and then you've got to drill down in terms of what we're talking about. The fact is that the system of, if we take the idea that people could get property and they could get capital and they could develop industries and so on, and if they were wealthy enough to do it, that helped generate America in terms of being an economic powerhouse. Now a lot of people were deprived because of that. There's a lot of inequality in it, but if you think about what America became between the 18th and the 20th century, you know, it became one of the wealthiest countries in the world because of the type of economic system that it had. As well as the fact, by the way, that they exploited all the territory that the Native Americans had, which is what they don't generally talk about. But that's maybe a different matter for a different day. The issue with capitalism is, and it's one that America has faced, is, wait a minute, though, is unrestricted capitalism. And there have been people who have advocated unrestricted capitalism, including the social Darwinists. You know, look, let the fittest survive, right? And if you die off because you don't have a house and because you don't have an education, well, you just weren't meant to be. To be honest with you, America didn't go full-blown unrestricted capitalism if you go back to the 1930s, right, where they brought in the New Deal and they brought in Social Security and Medicare and so on. So America's always had a bit of a mixed system. It's just had this capitalist slogan on it. The real tension has been is when the slogan has been one where America has not dealt with its problems of inequality and poverty. And there have been cycles of this. America did try to deal with this in the 1960s, but this was the horror of the Vietnam War. Had America not gotten involved in that horrible Vietnam War, the 1960s could have been this best, one of the best projects you turn in terms of, because it put money into the system for helping people across of it. But Vietnam got in the way. Then, of course, you get cycles like the 1980s under Ronald Reagan, where you roll back against it. And then to an extent with the Bush administration in the early 21st century. So once again, as I was saying with right and left, I tend to say, look, capitalism versus socialism, let's just push the slogans away. And let's talk about what a decent country should provide for its citizens. There should be incentives for people to go out and to be able to earn money, in my belief. It should not be a system which is a completely, for example, communal system, communist system. I don't think that works. But at the same time, people who do make money, who do profit, and that's fair enough, they should pay taxes back into a system which provides for those who aren't as fortunate, who haven't had the same opportunities, or haven't been able to build up something, not because they are, you know, substandard, not because they are in, you know, subhuman. Simply, they haven't been able to get the success. Because the point that I go back to when I said is, if you didn't know how wealthy you were, if you didn't know how your business was doing, if you didn't know how much you made in the stock market, what would you agree upon that all people should be able to have? And that's the way I would navigate between the capitalism and socialisms. And I can't navigate with communism because my mother wouldn't speak to me again. So we'll leave that one off the side.
It's interesting that you mentioned taxes, and that actually brings me to Nigeria, because one of the questions that I have for you is, so two things. One, you don't like the word capitalism, but I'm still going to use the word capitalism. Capitalism at the moment, I would argue, has morphed, or should I say has matured, if you like, or occupied as Big Brother, which is now becoming AI, which is now trying to control this apparent free speech, you know, and freedom to behave, freedom to be as we are, as we're supposed to be, number one. So that's one question on the side. Those basics that you're talking about are the base of what we call an umbrella name of basic human rights, housing, the, you know, education, health, all the things that, you know, everybody's entitled to, right? We're all entitled to it. Now, that brings me on to that taxes, the taxes that you mentioned, because those are the top who have more money, who earn more, are supposed to pay higher taxes so that those at the bottom are able to aspire to the middle and take our way upwards. In Nigeria, we have a clash, Prof. We have a disappearing middle class. Literally. When I say disappearing, it's disappearing to the point of, some would even say, it doesn't exist anymore. Yet we have an elite class that continues to actually be the weakest link. In an article I wrote this week, that continues to be the weakest link. What is a country like Nigeria to do? Because our elites, the average Nigerian elite, would not pay the taxes that they would in the UK, you know, in the US, in Germany, or whatever, even in Norway, in Scandinavian countries, right? And now we have a growing population of the poor who are not able to aspire to a middle class that's disappearing. In short, I'm telling you, Nigeria is a mess. We don't know what to do. Our elites are letting us down. And there's no more middle class. So what is to happen to the lower working class? What are they to do? How do we fix this?
Yeah. First of all, send me what you wrote. Because okay. I want to see that, right?
I will. Okay. I will.
I want to be careful because, of course, I'm not here to tell Nigeria what to do.
No, but I'm asking you. I'm asking you. So please.
I'm starting off with, in terms of not just for Nigeria, although I will refer to Nigeria, but to any country in this situation, here's a starting point, and that is what you would hope for is that everybody buys into the same vision. Mm. You would hope that the elites buy into the same vision that those who are the working classes and aren't as well off would buy into, which is, look, let's provide for everyone in the country, right? You would hope that's how. And to be honest with you, although it's not perfect and whatever, you've referred to the Scandinavian model. And by and large, that's the Scandinavian political culture. They do pay much higher taxes, but that's because the elites generally have bought into the idea we have a shared responsibility here. Now, if you do not get that from the elites, what you're asking me is, what are we going to do? Because the elites aren't going to provide, they aren't providing for, you know, they're not paying their taxes. They're not providing for our transport. They're not providing for our education. They're not providing decent hospitals, etc. The snap answer that people tend to give is, well, you can vote the rascals out. You can vote someone in, right? Mm. And the problem here is, what if you don't have a single party that you can go to on this? And what if the parties are just simply there to get power for themselves and their buddies and so on?
Like we have in Nigeria. The ones we have in Nigeria are literally brothers, cousins. They marry each other. They just got different names and they make up the elite.
Yeah, and what I come back to is something which will not be immediate comfort, but it's what I always come back to, and that is, you go back to the grassroots, you go back to communities, and remember, of course, communities and communal come from the same word, and that is, what is happening in your neighborhood? What is needed in your neighborhood? And if the government is not providing it, can your community provide it? Can you get together and provide it, right? If the government isn't providing for decent schools for your kids, can you help provide that type of education?
Mm.
If the government isn't providing for the healthcare and so on, what skills do you have in your communities? And what voice do you have in your community to make this known? Now, of course, we have the problem of repression. We have the problem that people will try to shut down dissent and so on. But I think what I would say is, what I've discovered, and I can tell you later on in another program about the differences between community in the US and the UK and in Ireland, and it's fascinating. The more that people talk to their next door neighbor, talk to their people who are across the street and down the street,
mm-hmm.
and about what they each need and what we can do about it, you can take small steps forward in terms of that.
Mm.
One of the interesting things I found out, by the way, during COVID, which I found so interesting, during that horrible, horrible time, is that once we realized that the government couldn't come in and sweep the pandemic away, and once we realized that our lives were so disrupted about it, at least where I was in the UK, we started talking to our neighbors again.
Mm.
We started talking about how we could make do, right?
Mm.
We started talking about how we could make sure everyone got food, including the elderly, for example.
Mm.
We talked about how we could make sure the kids got taught. And then, of course, the pandemic was over and we were back to, well, you know, I think the more that you get back to that sense of the community, and I'm going to flip something on you, by the way, which is AI and social media are tools. They're tools which can be used for very damaging effect.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're listening to this, Elon Musk, I hate you. I hate you, Elon Musk. I just want you to know that what you've done to Twitter. But they can also be used for good.
Mm.
And the thing about using social media is the use of social media to communicate with others who are near you, who live near you, or mm-hmm. who live quite a far away, to share these thoughts and so on. Because once you have realized that there are people out there who feel like you do, but who want something to be done about this, then there's a little bit of empowerment that takes place.
Mm.
You just have to reach out to find it from each other.
Indeed. You can call back whoever you... I didn't want to interrupt, Prof. So if you call back now, whoever was calling earlier, I promise to pick up your calls, but I don't want to interrupt him once he starts talking. So what I'm hearing from you is the solution, if I bring it to Nigeria, I know you're trying to say you don't want to tell Nigerians. Well, I'm a Nigerian Brit, so I'll tell the Brits what to do and tell the Nigerians what I think as well. And what you're saying is go back to that place of collective community needs, wants and solution. That's where the freedom lies, rather than expecting, the elites within our society to do better. But what if I said to you, that sounds very flowery. It's a very romantic notion. But how realistic is it? Because, again, if I refer to my article, and I will send it to you, there's something I call African billionaireism, right? It's a new term that I came up with. What is African billionaireism versus Western billionaireism? Okay, is that Western billionaireism, although built on greed and ego, right, and taking more than they actually need, still has the shame of actually using that ego to invest in societal structures, you know, theaters and I don't know, libraries and educational structures, you know, those things, universities, the Harvards, the Tate Museums, the theaters and all of that stuff. That is the if you like, I don't want to say the good, but if you like, the sort of shame covering of Western billionaireism. African billionaireism, on the other hand, tends to look towards the outside. The look at the poor in the society, that community, that collective community, where we are, you know, who are trying to exist and do the best that they can, even though there's no direct water, there's no school, there's no health infrastructure. The African billionaire looks beyond them and still looks to that West. The West, that where their fellow billionaires are already investing to make their areas better. So how do the poor own that power? How do they get that power? How do they seize that space back in order to aspire? Because without a middle class, where are they going to aspire to? Am I creating problems?
No, you're actually raising the problems that we need to talk about.
Thank you.
Which is that once upon a time, I dare say that in Nigeria, the question was, well, how do we get power for ourselves from the British? Right? Because it's the British who run things. It's the British who, of course, will look back to the United Kingdom or look back to England. You know, they're not us. What were they? Now what you're telling me is we've got an elite who say they're Nigerian and so on, but they use the get out of responsibility free card, which is, well, if things go wrong, they can blame the West. Oh, it's the West that did this and so on. And meanwhile, they can send their money abroad to the West and try to make their profits over there rather than investing back into the community. You know, there are some countries who've tried to achieve this by simply overthrowing the elites. But the problem here then is you tend to get new elites who tend to be in it for the power that take place, whether those are military or whether those are civilian. So I don't advocate going down that route. It is flowery. It is perhaps utopian what I say. But the reason why I say it is I don't think it will. You'll see me looking off camera because I'm having to try to think through this. It might not change things in 1 year, 2 year, 5 years. But if you start with the community, even if you don't wind up getting that water supply that you need immediately, even if you don't wind up getting that school that you need immediately, if you promote, and now we get back to ideas and ideologies. If you promote those ideas and ideologies of community responsibility amongst yourself, then the next generation comes forward, which perhaps will not look to the West, not go out to the West, but will look to their communities and say, this is where Nigeria is. And this is why Nigeria is not sense of a nationalism. This is where Nigeria is in terms of our people, our community, making lives better for everybody. It takes a long time. But if you think back to what the ethos was of a lot of the leaders who advocated for independence in Africa, also in Asia, in the Middle East, that's actually what they talked about back then. They talked about communities claiming power, not just simply so they could have profit at the top, but claiming power for everyone. Some of those nationalists, when they got into power, tried to fulfill that. Some of them, unfortunately, tried to just take powers for themselves. But I would go back to that as a starting point, which is, even though you have your independence, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And you've got to go back to where you go with those steps. And if you can't have leaders that deliver it for you, you talk amongst yourselves as to how do you build it up in your own area.
Thank you. 0700-993-993-993. And the female only line is 0802014657190. As you can see, I'm enjoying this conversation with Prof. It's not often that, you know, we get to unpack the sort of social structure in Nigeria, the social structure versus the political structure versus capitalism and elitism, etc. A lot of people are afraid to talk about it because it kind of gets into that intellectual space that many become uncomfortable with. Do I have a question here? I can't read it properly, so you'll have to resend it. Let me talk about world leaders because we're about to close. If I'm able to get... Oh, hold on. I better pick up this call. I think that's the same person that's been trying to call. Hello?
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 Good evening. I can't hear you properly. Hello?
Hello? This is Patrick Adamasi again. I'm going to ask your guest, why is China penetrating Africa and helping Africa